Welcome back for another deep dive. Today we'll be looking at Anderson v. Celebrezze. It's a case that even just the name sounds kind of dry, right? Like, oh, ballot access deadlines, who cares? But this case really gets to like some fundamental questions about how we balance state power and voting rights. Like, what happens when these two things collide?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's fascinating how a case from 1983 can still feel so relevant today. We're still wrestling with these same questions about how to ensure fair elections, without creating total chaos.
Right, exactly. So to understand what's at stake here, let's rewind back to 1980. We've got John Anderson, former Congressman Republican, decides to run for president as an independent candidate. Like, hey, I'm going to shake things up.
Seems simple enough, right?
Yeah.
But then he runs into this roadblock in Ohio, specifically their early filing deadline for independent candidates.
Deadline? Like, what do you mean?
So Ohio had this rule that said independent candidates had to file their candidacy paperwork by March 20th. Which sounds reasonable on the surface, but here's the catch. That was 5 months before the major parties even held their conventions.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So like way before anyone even knew who the nominees were going to be.
Exactly. And of course, Anderson misses the deadline. He tries to file later, but the Ohio Secretary of State, a guy named Celebrezze, basically says, nope, too late.
So most people would probably just give up at that point. But Anderson, he's not giving up. He takes this fight all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Argues that this early deadline is violating his rights, and even more importantly, the rights of voters who might want to vote for him.
And to everyone's surprise, the Supreme Court agrees with him.
They actually sided with Anderson.
In a 5-4 decision, no less, they strike down Ohio's deadline, saying it places an undue burden on voting rights. Especially considering how early it is in the election cycle. Like, imagine having to decide what you're having for dinner before you've even seen the menu.
Right, it's like making people choose before they even know all their options.
Mm-hmm.
But when states argue that they need these deadlines to ensure that elections run smoothly? Like, isn't that part of their job?
Absolutely. States have a legitimate interest in managing their elections. And that's where the Anderson test comes into play. This case didn't just settle one dispute. It created a whole framework for evaluating these kinds of ballot access cases.
Okay, so the Anderson test, it forces the courts to weigh the burden on voting rights against the state's interest in running elections.
Exactly. Think of it like a scale. On one side, you have the burden on the candidate and the voters. On the other side, you have the state's reasons for the restriction. And the court has to decide which side carries more weight.
So, like, if a state requires, I don't know, 50,000 signatures to get on the ballot, that's a huge hurdle for a smaller party or an independent candidate.
Right. The court would then look at the state's justification. Maybe they say it's to prevent frivolous candidates or ensure serious contenders, and then they'd weigh those reasons against the burden on the candidate and the voters.
So in Anderson's case, the court basically said that Ohio's reasons for that early deadline weren't strong enough to justify shutting out potential candidates so early in the game.
Precisely. They basically said, look, voter education and ensuring a stable political landscape, those are important goals, but they don't outweigh the right of voters to have a meaningful choice on their ballot.
But, I mean, it wasn't a unanimous decision, right? There must have been some justices who felt like the court was stepping on the toes of states' rights, like interfering with their ability to run their own elections.
You're right. It was a 5-4 decision. And Justice Rehnquist, he led the dissent. He argued that states should have more autonomy in managing elections. He felt that Ohio's deadline was reasonable and that the court was essentially second-guessing the state's judgment.
Interesting. So it's that classic tension between federal power and states' rights. Like, where do we draw the line?
Exactly. And Anderson puts that tension front and center. It raises this fundamental question. How much power should the federal government have in dictating how states run their elections?
So really, Anderson v. Celebrezze, it wasn't just about John Anderson and his presidential ambitions. It was about establishing a principle that states can't just do whatever they want when it comes to ballot access.
Right. It's about protecting the right to vote. And making sure that that right is meaningful and that voters have a genuine choice when they go to the polls.
Right, because ultimately it's about finding that balance between order and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a dance that we're still figuring out today.
Absolutely. It's an ongoing conversation. And Anderson is a key part of that conversation.
Okay, so Anderson wins his case at the Supreme Court. But what happens next? Like, did this actually change the political landscape? Did we see more independent and third-party candidates getting on the ballot?
Well, it's tough to say for sure if it was a direct result, but after Anderson, we definitely saw a number of high-profile independent and third-party runs, like Ross Perot in 92 and 96, Ralph Nader in 2000, you know, those candidates who kind of shook things up.
Right. I remember Perot. Like, it felt like he really tapped into something.
Yeah.
Do you think those campaigns would have even been possible without the precedent set by Anderson?
It's hard to draw a direct line, but I think it's safe to say that Anderson at least helped create an environment where those voices could emerge. And it forced the major parties to pay attention to issues and voters that they might have otherwise ignored.
Right. It's like suddenly the two-party system had to acknowledge that there were other perspectives out there, other options for voters.
Exactly. And that's a healthy thing for a democracy, right? You want a system where diverse viewpoints can be expressed and debated.
But isn't there also a risk that having too many candidates on the ballot could actually dilute the vote? Like it could lead to less decisive outcomes and make it harder to actually get things done.
Yeah, that's a valid concern. And it's something that political scientists and legal scholars still debate today. Does easier ballot access actually strengthen or weaken democracy? Is it a gateway to greater representation or just a recipe for gridlock and instability? There's no easy answer.
So even if Anderson didn't single-handedly change the political landscape, it definitely stirred the pot. It got people thinking about the role of third parties and independent candidates and the importance of ballot access.
Absolutely. It injected a dose of uncertainty into the system and reminded everyone that the two-party system isn't the only game in town.
So, okay, Anderson made a splash back in the 80s, but what about more recently? Is the Anderson test still relevant today? Like, is it still being used in legal challenges to ballot access?
Oh, absolutely. It's been cited in tons of cases challenging all sorts of restrictions, like signature requirements, fusion voting laws, you name it.
Wow. So it's like this case from 1980 is still shaping election law today.
Exactly. It's become a cornerstone of ballot access litigation.
I'd love to hear an example, like a more recent case that really shows how the Anderson test is being applied.
Sure. A great example is the 2019 case Libertarian Party of Virginia v. Judd. In that case, the Libertarian Party was challenging Virginia's requirement that candidates for statewide office gather 10,000 signatures from registered voters, including at least 400 from each of the state's 11 congressional districts.
Wow, 10,000 signatures. That's a lot,
yeah,
especially for a smaller party.
Right. And the Libertarian Party argued that this requirement was way too burdensome. It made it incredibly difficult for them to get their candidates on the ballot.
So how did the court rule?
The court ultimately sided with the Libertarian Party. They said that the signature requirement, especially that distribution requirement across districts, was placing an undue burden on ballot access without a strong enough justification from the state.
Interesting. So they were using the Anderson test to weigh those competing interests.
Exactly. Virginia argued that they needed the signature requirement to prevent unqualified candidates and ensure that candidates had broad support. But the court said those reasons weren't good enough to outweigh the burden on the Libertarian Party's right to participate in the election.
So in a way, the court was saying, look, we get that states want to have some control over who gets on the ballot, but they can't just erect these arbitrary barriers that make it practically impossible for smaller parties and independent candidates to compete.
Right. And that's the legacy of Anderson. It established this principle that ballot access is a fundamental right. And states can't just restrict that right without a very compelling reason.
But some people argue that cases like this actually favor small parties over the will of the majority.
Yeah.
Like if you make it too easy for everyone to get on the ballot, doesn't that undermine the whole concept of majority rule?
That's a great point. And it gets to the heart of what we're really talking about here. Like, what is the purpose of democracy? Is it solely about majority rule?
Yeah.
Or is it also about ensuring that minority voices have a chance to be heard?
Right. Like, where do you draw the line between protecting the rights of the majority and making sure that everyone has a fair shot at participating in the system?
And the courts, through cases like Anderson, have generally leaned toward the idea that a healthy democracy needs a marketplace of ideas, even if some of those ideas aren't widely popular.
I see. So it's not just about who wins the election. It's about making sure that there's a robust and diverse political discourse, that all viewpoints are represented in the conversation.
Exactly. And that's something that Anderson v. Celebrez really helped to solidify.
But even if we have fair ballot access rules, there are still other factors that can influence who gets elected, right? Like campaign finance laws, the role of money in politics.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a whole other can of worms. You know, we can talk all day long about making sure that everyone has a fair shot at getting on the ballot. But if the system is rigged in favor of those with the most money, then what's the point?
Right. It's like you can have the most level playing field in the world, but if only a select few can even afford to play the game, then it's not really fair at all.
And that's something that we need to grapple with if we truly want to create a more equitable and representative democracy.
So we've talked about legal battles, court decisions, the influence of money. Like, it's a lot to take in. Where do we even go from here? Like, what can everyday people actually do to make a difference in this whole ballot access thing?
Well, I think the first step is just staying informed and engaged. It's easy to feel overwhelmed by all the complexities of the system. But the more we understand these issues, the better equipped we'll be to advocate for change. You know, knowledge is power.
So do your research. Read up on these cases. Try to understand the arguments from all sides.
Exactly. And don't just rely on one source of information. Seek out diverse viewpoints. Challenge your own assumptions. Engage in those sometimes uncomfortable conversations with people who see things differently, you know? That's how we move beyond the partisan gridlock and start finding some common ground.
It's like good advice for life in general, right? Not just election law. Hmm. But are there more like concrete actions people can take? Like, are there organizations or initiatives that people can get involved with?
Absolutely. There are tons of groups working to protect voting rights and promote fair elections. Some focus on legal challenges like the ones we've been talking about, while others work on voter education and mobilization.
So there's a role for everyone to play, right? Whether it's donating to a legal defense fund, volunteering to register voters, even just talking to friends and family about the importance of participating in our democracy.
Exactly. Every voice counts and every action can make a difference. We can't just sit back and expect others to fix the system for us. We all have a responsibility to participate and make our voices heard.
That's a really powerful message. And it's been incredibly eye-opening talking to you about all this. I feel like I've gained a much deeper understanding of the challenges and complexities surrounding ballot access. But more importantly, you've reminded me of how important it is for everyone to get involved, you know, to not just sit on the sidelines, but actually participate in shaping the future of our democracy.
Well said. It's been a pleasure exploring these issues with you. And I hope our listeners feel empowered to do the same, to engage in this crucial conversation and make their voices heard.
Before we go, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought. Yeah. You've talked a lot about balancing competing interests, like state autonomy versus individual rights, majority rule versus minority representation.
Yeah.
But is there ever a point where those interests are just completely irreconcilable? Like, are there situations where there's simply no way to find a solution that satisfies everyone?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there are definitely situations where it feels impossible to find a solution that makes everyone happy. Take the issue of voter ID laws, for example.
Oh, yeah. That's a hot-button issue for sure.
Proponents argue that voter ID laws are essential to prevent voter fraud and protect the integrity of elections. But opponents say that these laws disproportionately disenfranchise minority voters and those who lack easy access to photo identification.
So it's like you have these two deeply held values: ensuring fair elections and protecting the right to vote. And they seem to be at odds with each other. How do we even begin to navigate those kinds of conflicts?
Well, it comes back to what we were discussing earlier about dialogue and compromise. We need to keep talking.
Yeah.
Keep listening. Keep searching for common ground. Recognize that there are often multiple valid perspectives on these complex issues, and be willing to consider different approaches and compromise where possible.
So it's not about finding the perfect solution, but about finding a way to move forward together, even when we don't agree on everything.
Exactly. Democracy is messy. It requires constant dialogue and negotiation. There will always be disagreements, but that's part of what makes it work. It forces us to confront difficult questions, to challenge our own assumptions, and to strive for a system that reflects our shared values.
That's a great way to put it. This idea of continuous dialogue and compromise, that's a powerful message to end on. It reminds us that the work of building a more perfect union is never truly finished. It requires ongoing vigilance, critical thinking, and a willingness to engage in good faith with those who hold different views.
Well said. And I think if this deep dive has inspired even a few listeners to become more informed and active participants in our democracy, then we've accomplished something truly meaningful.
I agree. Thanks again for joining us on this exploration of Anderson v. Solares and the ongoing struggle for ballot access in America. We encourage you to continue the conversation, to learn more about these critical issues, and to find your own way to contribute to a more inclusive and representative democracy.